Okay, it's wonderful to be at the PI as always. I'm going to talk about some work which is in progress with Hugh Thomas, who's a mathematician at the University of Montreal, and Yaroslav Trinka. And just for local interest, I can't resist telling you that Hugh is someone I've known since I was in grade 10 and he was in grade 9, and we met here in Waterloo. Anyway, it's sort of amazing that all these years later we're actually writing a paper together. So, the subject, what I'd like to explain in this talk is the words in the title. So I'm talking about the latest developments in linking scattering amplitudes in n equals 4 super Young Mills and positive geometry. Along the lines of trying to better understand this geometric structure that we called the amplitahedron a number of years ago. So what I'd like to tell you about is a more invariant understanding of what the amplitahedron is. On the one hand, that's a statement about geometry. On the other hand, it's associated with a new picture for what the scattering amplitudes are, which thinks about scattering amplitudes not as as functions of momenta. And in a supersymmetric theory, you normally think of it as functions of momenta and certain Grassmann variables that encode all the information about helicities, but rather as certain differential forms. And all of the Grassmann odd part of scattering amplitudes just goes into the D's of the differential forms in a natural way, and all of it together is going to give I think a quite new interpretation and understanding of what the amplitahedron is trying to tell us. Something that I won't have time to talk about, also because it's just really in progress and just developing, is that this picture. I think is strongly associated with a geometric object I've been looking for a long time, very long time, which is a kind of a dual of the amplitahedron, a dual in the same sense that we can talk about duals of polygons and polytopes, where you exchange points with planes. Okay, so this is something with lots and lots of indirect indications for a long time that there's a dual representation of the amplitahedron. And while we still don't exactly know what it is, I think this description of the amplitahedron that I'm going to tell you today is going to be the starting point to properly reveal it. Just getting into the meat of the subject, I want to give enough of an introduction to the amplitahedron so at least you have one concrete definition for the objects that we're talking about, the one that we started off talking about, before giving you the new definition for it, and I think motivating why we're thinking about things in this way. But it's not going to be. If I wanted to completely explain the connection between the geometry and scattering amplitudes at the level of the amplitahedron, that would be a whole talk in itself. So I'm mostly going to focus on just defining the geometric space to begin with. And then we'll transition to the different way of talking about that geometry before I explain how it's connected to the amplitudes in a rather different way than it was before. All right. So first one. So we have a lightning review of the amplitahedron itself. And any of you who have suffered through talks of mine on this subject know that it all begins by drawing a picture of a triangle and generalizing it in a variety of ways. Just so I don't disappoint you, I will talk about that picture of the triangle in a second. But just so you know where things are going, later I'm going to say that that picture was too complicated and we had to actually start with a picture of an interval instead. Okay, so. But anyway, we're going to start off thinking about triangles. So what we'd like to do is first imagine how we talk about points on the inside of a triangle. So if you imagine that I give you coordinates for the vertices of this triangle. And of course, I can give them to you as two-dimensional vectors. But it's more convenient to think of everything projectively. So think about everything projectively in RP2. And I think about all of those as three-dimensional vectors up to rescaling. So all the ZAs are three-dimensional vectors modulo rescaling. But I'm just going to think about them from now on as three-dimensional vectors. And then if I want to talk about a point in the interior of the triangle, then points on the interior of the triangle are points of the form C1, Z1 plus C2, Z2 plus C3, Z3, where the C's are positive. Now, of course, the C's are also only really defined. The C's are defined up to GL1. I can rescale all the C's by the common overall constant. So when I say they're all positive, I really mean they're either all positive or all negative. But from now on, I'm going to just abuse notation a little bit and just say that they're all positive. So here we have, then we have the points on the inside of a triangle are C1, C2, C3 mod GL1 with all the C's positive, repeating it. And so we can generalize from a triangle to a simplex to a tetrahedron. But there is one more generalization that we can make to the positive Grassmannian. And let me just explain this sequence of generalization. So here, I can think of this as, in general, some C1 through Cn mod GL1 with all the C's positive. But I can, instead of thinking about these as individual numbers, or if you like, as a 1 by n matrix, I can think of this as giving me a ray that passes through an origin in an n-dimensional space. So the space of all C's mod GL1 is just a projective space, Pn minus 1, space of all rays through the origin. And in that projective space, there's a particular part of it, this positive part of it, where all the C's are positive. And that corresponds to the inside of a simplex. So now we can generalize that idea by imagining the space of all K by n matrices that pass through an origin in some n-dimensional space. So if I want to specify a K by N matrix, if I want to specify a K plane in N dimensions, I can specify a K by N matrix whose rows are just some set of K n-dimensional vectors whose span defines the K plane. But if I now think of it as I did here, as a, instead a collection of of N K-dimensional vectors, then generalizing the notion of positivity here, well, it can't mean that I say that all the individual entries are positive, because that's not invariant under GLK transformations. If it's going to be about the plane, whatever I do has got to be invariant under GLK transformations. So the best I can do is to say that all the minors of this matrix are positive. Okay. So every time in the rest of the talk, I put something in brackets like this. It means I'm contracting them with the epsilon symbol. And so I have to choose an ordering now. So that's something I didn't have to do here. Here it's a permutation invariant statement in the n columns. But here I have to choose an ordering for the columns, 1, 2, up to n. And having chosen an ordering, I declare that all the minors are positive when they're ordered. Okay. So that space is the positive Grassmannian and has been studied. It's a much, much richer and more interesting space than just the simplices. It was defined in a sense. A whole class of spaces like this were defined by Lustig in the 90s in the way that we need it and think about it in relation to scattering amplitudes. It was studied by Posnikov in the 2000s, and it's completely understood. The interesting The novelty here is that this is a nonlinear statement. And if you want to ask what the boundaries of the positive Grassmannian look like, well, the boundaries of the simplex are trivial. The boundaries of an n-dimensional simplex is an n minus 1-dimensional simplex. Because really, I imagine these things are all greater than or equal to 0 in order to talk about the closure of the space. And so I can put one of these variables to 0 at a time, and that takes me to the boundaries. The difficulty with the positive Grassmannian is that we can't set any of these variables to 0 willy-nilly that we like because they satisfy relations between each other. And to give you a visualization of the positive Grassmannian, let me tell you what, just because I'll use it in a moment, let me tell you what G plus 3n looks like. Okay, not G2n, but G3n. So this is 3 by n. It's 3 by n matrices whose determinants are positive. Let me just assume that these columns have the top component all positive, just for simplicity. If they have the top component all positive, let me rescale them to 1, which doesn't change the fact that the minors are positive. So here I have a little, and here I have a little two-dimensional vector, x1, x2, up to xn. So if I want to specify this 3 by n matrix, I would draw a bunch of points in the plane. Okay? And obviously, if these points are random, we will not have that all the determinants are positive here. So there has to be something special about how the points are arranged for all the minors to be positive, all the determinants to be positive. What special thing you need is clear, because this determinant with a half in front is just the area of the signed area of the triangle, x1, x2, x3. Okay? It's just the area of that. And so this tells you that if all of these determinants, order determinants, are positive, all the triangles have to be oriented the same way. And that forces this polygon to be convex. So already we see this link between positivity and more familiar convexity. And now you can see why the space G plus 3n is much more complicated and interesting than just a simplex. Because let's say I want to take this space and I want to set one of the minors to 0. Let's say I want to set the minor 1, 3, 5 to 0. Okay, so setting the minor 1, 3, 5 to 0 means that I want to make the points 1, 3, and 5 collinear to each other. Okay? Because I want to collapse the area of that triangle to 0. But if I make them collinear to each other, let's say by taking the point x3 and moving it, and I want to put it on the line 1, 5, well, before I get there, it's going to be on the line 2, 4. Okay? And if I push it past that point, the polygon will no longer be convex. So I can't just take any one of these conditions that I like and set it to 0 by hand. I have to, there are relations. There's orderings in which things are allowed to happen. And that's why I have a much, much richer structure of boundaries for these spaces. Anyway, so there's a big story for what the whole positive Grassmannian looks like, but there's an association between these cells or these faces of the positive Grassmannian and on-shell processes that you can use to build scattering amplitudes. But that's sort of natural because triangles lift into the positive Grassmannian. And so all the different sort of pieces from which you can build amplitudes are like someone handing you a bunch of different triangles and telling you that it's gluing into a shape without telling you what the shape is or why you're putting them together in that particular way. So for that, you need a second, we need a second generalization, and that's what the amplitahedron is about. So for this second generalization, we first imagine generalizing from a triangle to the inside of a convex polygon. Now, how do I think about the inside of a convex polygon? I can think about it in exactly the same way as I think about the inside of a triangle. If someone hands me the convex polygon, so if someone hands me all these coordinates, z1, z2, and so on, then again, all the points on the inside, one way of talking about them is all the points on the inside are of the form c1, z1 plus cn, zn. And again, it's true that all the c's are defined up to GL1 with the C's, with all of them positive. But there's an extra proviso that I need. I want the polygon to be convex, so that means that there's a restriction on the data as well. I have to take that all these determinants made out of the Z's are also positive. So I need two things in order to talk about the inside of a polygon. A, I need data, the Z's, which are a bunch of three-dimensional vectors, which are positive in the sense of the positive Grassmannian. So all their ordered minors are positive. That's fixed. These guys are fixed. But B, I want to take a positive combination of this positive external data. Okay? And so this jamming together of the two positivities specifies what I mean by the inside of the polygon. So, if I abbreviate this a little, I'm saying y which lives in P2 or G13, if you like, one planes in three dimensions. So C lives in the positive G1n, and the z's are I'll call it positive matrices because I'm not modding out by the GL3 acting on these guys. It's a minor difference. But positive matrices, M3n, so these are fixed. These vary. And this defines a region in, so this is some region in G13, which is the inside of the polygon. Okay. And so what we now want to do is generalize that idea. We want to lift this into the Grassmannian in exactly the same way we lifted the triangle into the Grassmannian. And if we do that, we get the first example of the amplitudehedron. So this is the amplitudehedron for tree amplitudes. And so what do I mean exactly? Well, I do really exactly what I said. So instead of having, here we had one y, and now I'm going to have ky's because I want a k-plane. So this index alpha is going to run from 1 to k, and I is going to run from 1 to some k plus m, something bigger than k. So this thing lives in G. This is going to be a region in G, k, k plus m. For physics, we'll need m equals 4, but we'll define these objects in general. But what region? Once again, I'm going to have some external data, zi, which are positive. So they're going to live in m plus k plus m and n. But I want a positive combination of this positive external data. And these c's are going to live in g plus k n. Okay? So you fix the z's as positive data. And the image of the positive Grassmannian under this map, y equals c dot z, is some region in gk, k plus m. Okay? All right, so that region is this is the tree amplitudehedron. And so this is some geometry. Okay, this is some geometry. Now, there's one final step, which I'm not going to talk about in detail in the conventional picture that we started with, because we're going to give a different picture of it in a moment. But just from this picture, we learn some way to remove particles. From the geometry, it means some canonical way to project away from points preserving this positive structure. It turns out to be very constrained. There's a very specific way that you have to hide particles. And doing that generalizes a tree amplitudehedron to the loop level to the amplitudehedron that also calculates loops. Okay, so the general object. But I will talk about how that works in a little bit more detail. Mostly, to begin with, we're focusing on understanding the tree amplitudehedron. So as I said, for physics, we have m equals 4 for a physics. So I will talk about what the larger space is that the loop amplitudehedron lives in later when it comes up from the new point of view. Okay.
It's a region inside GK K plus M.
How do we get scattering amplitudes from it? How does it connect to a physics? Well, given this region that lives in GK K plus M, associated with this region is a certain form, omega. It's a top form, so it's a k times m form that depends on y. That's the thing that it depends on. And the z's are fixed external data. Okay? So there's a certain top form that lives in gk k plus m. And this top form is fixed by the requirement that it has logarithmic singularities on the boundaries of the ample tetrahedron. So this is the requirement that converts geometry into functions that we can compare to physical amplitudes and turns geometry into amplitudes. Now, in practice, it's not obvious ahead of time such a form exists. If you're given a region in a compact region in some space, it's not obvious there is a form of logarithmic singularities on the boundary of the region. What logarithmic singularities means is that in the neighborhood of any singularity of the, it's a rational form, in the neighborhood of any singularity of this object, there's local coordinates. If it's a D form, there are local coordinates where it looks like dx1 over x1 over dxd over xd. Okay, so that's what it means to have a form with logarithmic singularities. And so in general, it means that there is a choice of coordinates for which the form looks like the sum of a bunch of D logs of the correct number of variables. Okay, so this is a highly non-trivial fact. It's a highly non-trivial fact that that forms have this property. Okay, now everything that I told you is completely bosonic. So I also told you there's this form with logarithmic singularities. So where does the superinformation of a superamplitude come in? Well, part of the story here is that the z's are k plus m dimensional vectors. So if m is 4, there is four-dimensional part, and there's a k-dimensional part, which I can call c down here. It's a k-dimensional part. Now, what is it that defines the upper and the bottom parts of this k plus m vector? Well, it's the k-plane y that does it. So really, I have this k plus m-dimensional space, or k plus four-dimensional space in this case. There's a k-dimensional subspace, which is what this k-plane is. And in this k plus m dimensional space, the external data has a piece in it that's in the direction of y. That's these extra components. And the piece which is not in y, that's the four-dimensional component. Okay? So all of the super information, all the information about helicities, k, all those things in amplitudes, actually goes in this part. Okay? And so the ultimate object is totally bosonic. And we can extract from it super amplitudes in a particular way that I won't talk about here, because I'll give a different description for how to think about it in a moment. Okay, but now I want to focus more on the geometry. So there's a few funny things about this. There's a few funny things about this formulation. One is this is a highly redundant map. Even if we go back to polygons, if you want to decide whether a point is in a polygon or not, the map from C into Z is many, many to one, right? Because the space of C's is n minus one dimensional, whereas the polygon is two dimensional. So this is a very redundant map. So just as a practical question, if someone asks you, here's a point Y, is it in the polygon? Then while you could hunt around to see if you can write it as C dot Z with all positive C's, it's not effective. So that's one odd feature. Another odd feature I've alluded to already, that we have to introduce all these extra components, whereas this is the real bosonic data that we actually have in the problem. So we have to connect to physics, we have to introduce all these extra components. Yet another feature is that while mathematically all these m's are interesting and the objects somehow doesn't care about any particular one m or another, physics seems to select out m equals 4 and doesn't, on the face of it, seem to have room for any of the other things. So these are all slightly funny features, all of which are going to be explained in a moment from this new picture. Okay, so that's the, and maybe I'll say one more thing just to give a roadmap for where we're going. When you have polygons and polytopes more generally, there are famous, ancient, obvious dual descriptions of polytopes. On the one hand, so if you have a bunch of, so let's just talk about in the case of polygons even, right? So if you have a polygon, One way of describing it is just what I said. Y is C dot Z. But there is a more effective way of describing it, which is to say that Y is on the right-hand side of all of these boundaries. Okay? In other words, it satisfies a bunch of inequalities, right? So this is the vertex-centered way of describing. This is the vertex-centric definition of a polytope. Or another set of words for it is convex hull, right? You give a bunch of vertices, and you take a weighted sum of all the vertices with the weights positive. But there's the face-centric way of talking about it, which is to say, so if y has upstairs indices projectively, then there's the face-centered way of saying it, which is that there's a bunch of faces w with a lower index, and these are all positive. Okay, so this is the face-centric definition of a polytope. So this is intersection of half spaces, another way of saying it. Okay. And there's, like I said, a famous, not 1,000,000%, 100% obvious theorem, but very simple to prove. And it's in convex analysis 001, there's something called Farkas theorem that tells you you can always go from one to the other. So that if you have a set of vertices, you can find a set of faces, and vice versa. You can also see why this is going to be related to trying to find some dual of the objects that we're interested in, because the vertices of the dual polytope are exactly these w's. So this is saying that if you want to describe a polytope, you can either describe the vertices of the polytope or the vertices of the dual polytope. So trying to find this description is related to the beginning of discovering what the dual polytope is. Anyway, so to begin with, what we'd like to do is to find the analog of that statement. Okay, let's find the analog of the statement that y dot w is a positive. In other words, can we specify what the amplitudehedron is just by specifying a bunch of inequalities that have to be satisfied to chop it out as an actual, as an actual space like that, instead of giving it this implicit definition in terms of y equals c dot z? And this is, of course, a very obvious question. And we thought about it from day one, but the answer seemed to be no, that it is not possible to talk about it like that. And there's a very simple counterexample already. The simple counterexample is just for positive G24. Okay, just the simplest thing of all. So here we just have a 2x4 matrix, all of whose minors are positive. In this case, there is a single relation that's satisfied between the minors. It's the either called a Plucker relation or a Schouten identity, depending on your culture. But anyway, this is the relation between the 2x2 determinants of this matrix that are satisfied. And so now, remember, what the positive Grassmannian is a statement that all these minors ij are positive if I is less than j. Okay? And that's clearly compatible with this relation, because if everything is positive here, well, this is positive. The left-hand side is a positive. But you can ask, is it enough to specify what the boundaries are? You see, here we have these sort of first boundaries, and we just say that y is on the right-hand side of the first boundaries. In the case of the positive Grassmannian, the first boundaries correspond to setting 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 4, and 1, 4 to 0. You see, you can't just set 1, 3 to 0, because that would violate. If you set 1, 3 to 0, because it's the sum of two positive things, you'd have to set some of these things to 0 before you got to set 1, 3 to 0. So the boundaries of the positive Grassmannian, the boundaries are when 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 4, and 1, 4 go to 0. So you can ask, is it enough just to say that those are positive. And the answer is no, because that's compatible with 1, 3, and 1, 2, 4 either being both positive or both negative. And one of these things is the positive Grassmannian, and the other one is not. Okay, so you can't just specify what the boundaries are. So that's what seemed to be the problem. Okay, so now let me describe what the nature of the answer is that we found for what does work. And I could just jump to the end and tell you the most primitive answer, but it'll be a little more useful to do it in steps where they get sort of different views on the same final result. One is that it turns out we have to specify both the boundaries and a topological condition. In fact, it's a winding number condition. And I'll explain what that means. But two, there's an even more basic way of talking about it. In this more basic way, almost all of the structure in the problem disappears. Positivity disappears, positivity for the external data disappears, positivity for the Cs disappears. Everything is replaced by one basic requirement, which I'll talk about. And this basic requirement is, in a quite precise sense, that this geometry is a binary code. Okay. And you'll see what I mean by code. What this means is that if you look at this geometric configuration of points and this k-plane, and if you look at it like a code, you have to know how to look at the code to see the message. Here, you knowing how to look at it means that you have to project the picture through certain directions. And if you project the picture in certain directions, you have to have, in the end, a certain fixed pattern of pluses and minuses. And I'll describe what the pluses and minuses are, but it's quite literally a binary code. And requiring that binary code for all the possible projections fixes everything else. Okay? So let me try to explain these two things. First, the first picture a little bit more, just to gain a little bit of intuition. So remember, what we have here is we have data, which is k plus m dimensional, and we have y, which is a k-plane in k plus m dimensions. Now, there's a natural question. So let's say whatever m is. But there's a natural question. I said that the z's are positive as k plus m dimensional vectors. So let's say in the case of physics, we want m equals 4. But I told you that what we really care about bosonically is the top four components, right? So you can ask, what do those top four components, what do the ordinary bosonic momentum twister variables look like when the underlying data is positive? Okay? Remember, what defined the underlying data is the part that's not in y. So what that means geometrically is that we're just projecting through y. Okay? By projecting through y, I literally mean you imagine you have a bunch of the y is defined by a bunch of the span of a bunch of vectors, and you literally just project through them. You look at the picture in the direction of all of the of all those k vectors. Or said another way, it's a quotient space where you quotient out any two z's whose difference is contained in y. So now what I'm doing, I'm going from this k plus m dimensional picture to an m dimensional picture. Okay? And now there's a question, if y is in the amplitudehedron, if the z's are positive and y is in the amplitudehedron, what is special about what this m dimensional picture looks like? Okay? So let's choose the case where m equals 2 to get some intuition to begin with. So if m equals 2, and even in the simple case where n is equal to 4, then after I do the projection, I literally have a two-dimensional picture. Yeah. I have some two-dimensional picture. 1, 2, 3, 4. The data were four-dimensional vectors. If k equals, let's say k equals 2, the data were four-dimensional vectors. After I do the projection, they are two-dimensional vectors. The k-plane y gets projected to some point. The k-plane y gets projected to an origin in this picture. And so we can ask, what does it look like? And OK, if they're totally general, then if y is not in the amplitudehedron, there is some random picture. Okay? But if y is in the amplitudehedron, which in this case is just positive g24, the picture looks the following way. So y got projected to the origin. Again, these are all just two-dimensional vectors. And now this picture has the property. So when you're in the amplitudehedron, you have the property that y12 is positive, y23 is positive, 3, 4, 1, 4 is positive, and as it turns out, that y13 is negative, and y24 is negative. So this is what it takes to be in the amplitudehedron. All of these first four conditions just tell you that if you draw this path, 1 to 2, 2 to 3, 3 to 4, and 1 to 4, that they all wind around y in the same orientation. They're all always going around in the same direction. Okay? But on top of that, you have to demand that this path, the path that goes around, has winding number 1 around the origin. So that's the extra thing you have to say. That's the extra thing you have to say that goes beyond just a statement about the boundaries. Now, for ordinary polygons, these two things happen simultaneously. So if we say that we're on the inside, that means that we're on the right side of the boundaries. But it also happens to mean that if I take the path 1, 2, 2, 3, if I go around, you have winding number 1 around y. So it happened just in this special case that these two requirements were the same. However, in general, they're not the same. And you have to both impose that you're on the right side of the boundaries and that you have winding number 1. Okay? Just to contrast it, this is what it looks like when you're not in the amplitudehedron. 1, 2, 3, 4. You see, this is another picture where it's all the same. 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 4, and 1, 4 are all going in the same direction around y. But this has winding number 0. Okay, so this picture has winding number 1. And is in the amplitudehedron. This picture is winding number 0 and is not in the amplitudehedron. Okay, so instead of talking about playing with matrices and asking about determinants being positive and so on, this is now a practical check. If someone hands you a configuration of points and a k-plane, you just project through y. You look at the resulting picture. And the claim is that if k equals 2, you have to have that it's all winding around in the same direction, and that it has winding number 1. Okay? And in fact, when m is equal to 2, when m is equal to 2, and if we have k equals 1, k equals 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on, then the winding numbers that you have to be in the amplitudehedron, the winding numbers you need are 1, 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, and so on. Okay? And this turned out to be the maximal winding that you can have. It's possible to approve that. But now you can actually ask the question, does this sector with 0 winding have any meaning? And it does. The sector with 0 winding is a geometry whose volume, in the sense of this form with logarithmic singularities, corresponds. It turns out that now if we go to higher n, we just add more and more points, but you still have winding number 1 around everything. This geometry for m equals 2, k equals 2, turns out to calculate the one loop MHV amplitude. And the geometry with winding number 0 calculates the parity conjugate of that amplitude, the MHV bar amplitude. And in a moment, when I tell you the bigger geometry, you'll see that there is a simple geometry that calculates the correlation function in the light-like limit directly.
not the amplitude, but the correlator in the like-like limit, which is an interesting combinatorial sum of all the MHVs and MHV bars at different loop orders. That's actually one large geometry. And when you pick out the different winding number components, you are breaking it up into the pieces that correspond to the different sub-amplitudes that go into it. But anyway, this is a warm-up. You can now, this is just a warm-up to get you in the mood to think of what happens not in this big K plus M dimensional space, but in the space where you project through Y. And you think about what it looks like in the projected space. If you care about physical scattering amplitudes, this should make you happy, because now we've lost all the information about these higher extra components. We're now directly looking at what the physical data looks like. And the claim is that when the physical data is oriented in a way to have some correct winding number, that's what defines the amplitudehedron. When you go to higher m, m equals 4, which is what we care about for physics, you need a higher dimensional notion of a winding number. Okay? So here you have a sort of standard winding, which is to find a small S1 around the point and to find a path made out of the external data that's also homologous to an S1 and talk about how one winds around the other. And you need the generalization of that to a three-dimensional, to an S3, when you talk about the case for m equals 4 and higher. And here, as you go to large k, the winding number grows like k. For m equals 4, it grows like k choose 2. For m equals 6, it grows like k choose 3, and so on. So it's a more interesting notion of winding. But I don't want to pursue that story, because I want to now move to the, even more primitive definition of what is going on. I mentioned this first picture because it's slightly more intuitive, and it gives you. So you can see that this is now a practical check. You can see whether you're in or out taking the data, checking the obvious inequalities that correspond to the boundaries and computing the winding number. And the computation of the winding number is just it's a totally trivial algebraic calculation. There's no fancy integrals, nothing to be done. You just, to calculate the winding number, you pick any path away from the origin, and you just count which one of the boundaries that it hits, and you weight them with sign of the orientation of the boundary. And that's it. OK, but let me now move to the second thing, because I think it's more interesting. So to give a flavor for what we're going to think about, I want to go back to the good old picture of a triangle, or a square, and in a sense, the problem was that we are starting with a too complicated example here. So there's something even more basic than a triangle that we could have been talking about. Instead of talking about the notion of an inside of a triangle, we could just talk about the notion of the inside of an interval. So if you have point 1, 2, and you have something on the inside, y, how are you supposed to decide that y is between them? Okay? Of course, here too, we have the usual notions. It could be the weighted sum of 1 and 2 with positive coefficients. It could be on the right side of the boundaries of 1 and 2. But there's a third notion, which is that if you imagine taking the path from 1 to 2, you have to cross over y once. Okay? So that's an extremely basic definition of what it means to be on the inside. You take the path, and you count how often you jump over the thing that you're interested in, whether it's on the inside or not. Now, what's interesting about this is that when we move on, let me actually immediately move to a talk about this slightly more complicated case of a square. See, in what we were talking about in defining the amplitudehedron, we were, from the beginning, having two different ideas. First, that by hand, we demanded the external data as positive so that we're dealing with a convex polygon. Okay? So that means that we're dealing with that and not with that, right? Good, bad, right? And secondly, on top of that, that we are inside or outside for this guy, where here it wouldn't matter where you put it. It would be bad no matter what. Okay? So here we're first making a demand on the external data and then asking that we're on the inside. But there's a more basic requirement that in one go takes care of everything. And the more basic requirement is simply the following, that if you take this picture and you look at it in the direction of any of the vertices, so you project a two-dimensional picture to a one-dimensional picture, then if and only if you're on the inside of a convex polygon, you get the same story from every projection. And let's see what I mean by story. So let's say we project through 1. If I look in the direction of 1, what do I see? Well, I see a line. I see a line, and there's 2 on the line. There's 3. There's y and 1 that land on top of each other, right? The sort of origin of this projection, and 4. That's what it looks like when you project through y, through 1. Now, what happens when you project through 2? When you project through 2, you also see a picture. So this is project through 1. If I project through 2, then I see a picture that looks like 3, 4, then y and 2, and 1, and so on. Okay? In every projection, it has the feature that if you now take the path between the remaining guys in order, you cross over y exactly once. Okay? So in other words, every one of these projected pictures looks like a legal picture of inside in one dimension. Now, that's not true if it's anything else. For example, if you take this example, I just invite you to check that depending on who you project through, sometimes you'll cross over y twice. Sometimes you'll cross over at no time. Sometimes you'll cross over at once. You don't get the same answer you don't get the same answer no matter who you project through. Okay? So that's going to be the most primitive idea now, that we're going to demand, when are you in the amplitahedron? We're going to demand we have some external data, some external z data, and some k-planes that live in this k plus m dimensional space, but such that when we project through y to go down to this m-dimensional space, and now we're going to do some further projections to go down to a one-dimensional picture, that no matter how we get down to one dimension, you hop over y precisely k times. And that's the generalization away from polygons and polytopes, where k is equal to 1. Okay, we're going to hop over k times. So from this point of view, the most fundamental object is the m equals 1 amplitahedron. Okay? That's the most basic object of all. And so how do we decide whether we're in the m equals 1 amplitahedron or not? Well, this is very simple. So if I have y is a k-plane in k plus m equals 1 dimensions, and so I can just look at, so when I project through y, I get literally a one-dimensional picture, right? When I project through y, I get exactly the picture that we're talking about, whereas here's y, and here's 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. Okay? So in this case, when I project through y, I literally get a one-dimensional picture. And the claim is that this one-dimensional picture should hop over y k times. What that means in more algebraically is if I just take y is a k-plane, so I can soak up one more index by z1, z2, up to zn. What it means is that sequence has to have exactly k sign flips. Okay? And so that's what it takes to be inside the m equals 1 amplitahedron. What does it take to be in the m equals 2 amplitahedron? Well, what it takes to be in the m equals 2 amplitahedron is if you take, if you project through y, it should come to a two-dimensional space. And now you take any one of the z's and you project through it to go down to a one-dimensional picture, you should end up in the m equals 1 amplitahedron. Okay? So they're all continuously connected via projection. So to be in the m equals 2 amplitahedron, you have to look at this sequence. Y, for example, if I project through particle 1, y12, y13, up to y1n, this should have k sine flips. And similarly, all of them. So if I now look at y2, 3, y2, 4, up to y2n, and there's a y when you come back around, in general, there's a little minus sign that you have to put that depends on k, that puts the twisted cyclic, that takes care of the cyclic symmetry. But anyway, up to that sign, all of these guys have to have k sine flips. And if you say that, you don't have to say anything else. You don't have to say that the data is positive. You don't have to say anything about the structure. So it's really just looking at a pattern of pluses and minuses. Okay, so you take the geometry, it convert it to a pattern of plus or minus, and every string has to have precisely k flips of sign.
Is this lexical order?
Yes. Yeah. This is more basic. It's just direct order. So you start with y. So in general, for k equals 2, you really just start from ya and then a plus 1 up to ya minus 1. Okay?
And
it's just
ya plus 1.
Oh, all of them. That's right. Yeah. So no matter who you project through, so no matter which one guy you project through, everyone else cyclically ordered after it has got to have, yeah.
So you can print the sine flips also when you go from ya minus 1 to ya plus 1 plus 2?
No. It's done one at a time. So you have n sequences. That's right. You have n, each string is by itself. Each string by itself has to have k sine flips. Now, it turns out there are slightly more efficient ways of packaging this information. For example, you can show that I didn't say anything about the boundaries being correct. But if you put in information about the boundaries being correct, which in this case happens to be that y, za, za plus 1 is positive for all a, if you put in that information as well, then it suffices to check this for just one string, okay? And then all the rest of them follow. Okay? So it depends. The most efficient representation is just this for the m equals 2 amplitahedron, it's just y12 up to y1n has k sine flips. Okay. So the story for all higher m is exactly the same. There's only one proviso, which you see already, even in the simplest case where you have just the fewest number of particles to give you a basis for the big space. So when the z's are the identity matrix, if you like. You cannot just completely randomly project through arbitrarily distant points, because that will just change the orientation of the simplex. Okay? So if you just do the absolute simplest thing, just to make sure you don't change the orientation of the simplex, for a higher m, you have to project things two at a time where they're neighbors. So you can't project through 1, 7. But you can project through 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 4. Okay, so for all higher m than 2, for m equals 3 and higher, the rule is that you project through AA plus 1, BB plus 1, CC plus 1. You project through pairs in any way you like until you get to m equals 2 or m equals 1. If you get to m equals 2, you project through one more guy. If you get to m equals 1, you're done. And you just go down in the end for m equals 1, and you check that there's k sine flips for everybody. Okay. And so the definition, let's say, for the m equals 4 amplitahedron. So I gave you the most symmetrical definition. If you want to give the most efficient definition, now the boundaries are of the form y, za, za plus 1, zb, zb plus 1 is positive. And you just look at this sequence of sine flips, y1, 2, 3, y1, 2, 3, 4, up to y1, 2, 3, n. Has k sine flips. Okay. And that's the full definition of the amplitahedron. Okay. Now, what's interesting about this, so first, it's an effective definition now. So I'm really cutting out the space directly. It's something that's well defined in the, as I said, in the space of the momentum twisters directly themselves. Okay. So in this space, you have to have, Okay, so I've said this is really a picture of what that space looks like, right? What it looks like is when you look in any of these directions, projected through these directions, you come down to one-dimensional pictures with pluses and minuses that always tell the same story. So that's the binary code, right? They go plus, minus, plus, minus, plus, minus, always with k sine flips, and they have to say the same story no matter who you project through. Now, this is a kind of abstract, weird definition, right? So why? But what is fascinating about this definition is that by looking at sine flips, we can now see that the geometry satisfies factorization. Okay, so if you're going to have a form with logarithmic singularities on the boundary of the space, and if that form has the property that as the particle goes on shell, you factorize, then in the geometry, what that means, and this we've known for a long, long time, is that if you go to the boundary of the ample tetrahedron, you see as you approach the boundary that what the ample tetrahedron looks like on the boundary is splits into the product of two lower ample tetrahedra. Okay? Now, that fact we knew and we could check in many examples and so on, but in this C dot Z picture, there's still some non-triviality to sort of prove that the factorization really works in the way you expect and so on. Well, with zero time, I can't tell you how it works. But with the sine flips, you can just prove it just by keeping track of some dinky pluses and minuses as they move around. So there is something that is really, this sort of combinatorics is perfectly tailored to explaining the origin of factorization. This is for the tree ample tetrahedron. So now let me finish at least defining from this point of view what the loop ample tetrahedron is. Okay? And this is, so can I have five, 10 more minutes? Okay, thanks. Well, be very careful. So it's you don't owe me anything anymore. So it's if you ever did. So all right. So actually, maybe before going to the loop ample tetrahedron, let me just make a very quick comment about the scattering form. So what do I mean by this? So in this picture now, you see that all the action is happening for m equals 4 in the four-dimensional space of the bosonic momentum switches. That's great. That's where the data is. That's where the physical amplitudes live, right? But we needed this extra y stuff on the extra components to encode the k, to encode the information about eta. So that was something good about the old picture. We bosonized things, so supersymmetry. There was no supergeometry, ordinary bosonic geometry. But now, where is all that information going? If we can we think about it directly in the four-dimensional space? The answer is yes, and it's extremely simple. And you know, in 15 minutes, I could even derive all of it. But let me just tell you how to think about it. So, in the conventional picture, we imagine that the z's are fixed, and they're capless m-dimensional data, and we're moving around in y. So the form moves around in y, but it's a form that has logarithmic singularities on the boundaries of the ample tetrahedron. So let me, and this is for the cognoscenti, but let's say, imagine I want to write down in ample tetrahedron language how we would think about the form for an R invariant. So this is one of the elementary building blocks. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. One of the elementary building blocks that depends on 5 super momentum twisters. But in this ample tetrahedron language, where there is no, so normally this is a super object. So it's delta 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, a to 5 plus cyclic over 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way up to 5, 1, 2, 3. So this is normally a super object, which in ample tetrahedron language we interpret as a bosonic object in the following way. We actually write it as a d log of y 1, 2, 3, 4, y, say 1, 3, 4, 5 over y 1, 2, 3, 4 up to d log of 2, 3, 4, 5 up to y 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay? So one way of saying this is that this just corresponds to a this corresponds in a very simple way to a simplex. We want to say that y is c1 z1 plus c5 z5, and so
we can always gauge fix one of these things to be 1. And if we look at the form dc1 over c1 up to dc4 over c4, that's the form with logarithmic singularities on the boundary of the simplex. And that form is just equal to this guy. So what I want to stress is that this is a completely bosonic form. It depends on y. The z's are fixed. And then there is some very small dictionary that I'm not telling you for how to convert this bosonic expression into the super expression. Okay? But I'm not telling you because there's another way of converting them, which is the following. Imagine that I'm now doing the projection. I'm now projecting through y. I'm projecting through y to get the four-dimensional z's, just like we are talking about. In that four-dimensional world, the four bracket between the z's is exactly this expression, because I'm just projecting through y, right? So if I add y, that's what the brackets are between the objects. So let me just erase the y here. I now erase the y. But now you complain and say, well, this d used to be acting on the y's. The d used to be acting on the y's. Now what is it acting on? Well, now let it act on the z's. Okay. So this d acts on these four-dimensional z's now. So this is a nice four form. And how is it related to the R invariant? That's how it's related to the R invariant. So the claim is that if you take the if you take what we think of as a superamplitude, z that depends on z and eta, there's always a stupid thing you could have done. Many of us thought about doing this many times, to turn this into a differential form. You can always turn it into a differential form by just calling the eta, which is the Grassmann variable. You could call it a dz if you like. Okay? This is now a 4k form. Okay? But why the hell would you do that? This seems like a really stupid thing to do, especially because the z's and the eta's have two different indices acting on them, right? This is an SL4 index. That's an SU4R index. You would think no good will come of this awful operation. But in fact, it does. Okay? In fact, the claim is that this form is the amplitudehedron form. It is the amplitudehedron form, but under this projection. And in fact, let me actually say what the basic statement is. This is very closely related to things that were discovered about the sort of relationship between forms on the Grassmannian and superinvariants. So something that many people said long ago is that if we have these positive coordinates on the Grassmannian, and we have this 4k form on the Grassmannian, which is just the d-log of all these guys, but we have an expression that looks like delta 4k slash 4k. We have a k by n matrix that depends on these positive coordinates. Too many alphas. Sorry. Let's say this is positive coordinate z1. Too many z's. x1 up to x4k. So these are these nice coordinates that positively parametrize the positive Grassmannian. So the claim was that if we take this form, this form on the positive Grassmannian, then this produces the building blocks of the superamplitudes that has the full super has a full supersymmetry, in fact has a full Yangian invariance. But from this point of view, we are putting in a lot of malice of foresight about needing it to be supersymmetric and so on. There's something more basic we could have done if we didn't know anything about physics, but we just wanted to do a if we have these 4k dimensional cells, depends on x1 and x4k. We have these 4k dimensional cells of the positive Grassmannian, and these 4k dimensional cells intersect the external data. Now just I runs from 1 to 4 now. These four they intersect the external data. If I solve this equation, this intersects in points. In fact, typically in a point, it localizes some points x1 star up to x4k star. Okay, so just geometrically, the space of z's is a 4-plane. This is a k-plane, but this particular cell intersects the that plane in a point. So we can just ask the question, what is the pullback of this form? What's the pullback of this form on the Grassmannian
what's its pullback on Z space? Okay. So in other words, what is this form evaluated on? Because these things all depends on the Z. Okay. What is this form evaluated on X star of Z? Okay. And the answer is this is nothing other than the integral. Let me call it different variable now. dy1 through dy4k over y4k delta 4k c dot c of y dot z delta 4k c of y dot dz. Okay, so that's the relation between pullbacks of forms on Grassmannians and supersymmetry. Okay, so if you've never heard of supersymmetry, this is how you would discover it. Okay, you would discover that the dz's, what naively are totally random things that are actually come together in a way which are separately acted on by their own SU4 symmetry and behave exactly like super eta's. Okay? So this means that even tree amplitudes are differential forms. And they're written in terms of d-logs of nice objects made out of four brackets. This is very encouraging to the program of trying to understand the polylog structure and the cluster algebra structure in polylogs at loop amplitudes, because somehow we know in perturbation theory the trees come from loops, but there's always been an obstruction for what happens to the eta's. How do you get rid of the eta's? That there's this, now the eta's are gone. The variables are just identical, right? You have, in fact, what the amplitude is a certain 4K form that lives on exactly the space on which the polylogs are, the cluster structure on the polylogs is defined, okay? So, and anyway, there's a variety of other interesting things to say about that. I don't have time to explain it, but with this picture now, and what I told you about the binary code or the winding picture, you can completely describe what the ample dihedron is without ever talking about the 4 plus k dimensional space. Everything lives in the four-dimensional space of the ordinary bosonic momentum twister data, but you have to identify just in the configuration space of n four-dimensional vectors in that space, you have to identify a natural 4K dimensional subspace on which to pull back this form and discover that it has logarithmic singularities. And identifying that 4K dimensional subspace is just to pick some particular set of z's and translate them in the direction of a fixed K plane. And doing that is completely equivalent to introducing the extra data, the 4 plus k dimensional space, and so on. Anyway, but if I just have 5 more minutes, let me just explain the story of loops now. Because this is, I think, to me, it's the most surprising aspect of the story, because loops turn out to be much simpler than at least I thought they were going to be. OK, so.
Exactly.
That's naively very surprising. Why wouldn't that happen? But this connection with the Grassmannian, just pulling back the form, just that little stupid exercise that I showed you shows that what you get, it never happens because it looks like a delta 4 c dot z, delta 4 c dot dz. So indeed, you don't. And of course, something that you can do, even if we didn't know this, nothing would have stopped us to take the superamplitude and turn it into a form. But why would we expect there's anything good about this form? Now the claim is it is this form that has logarithmic singularities. See, now you can do something with this form. You can integrate it on cycles. We didn't know how to integrate superamplitudes before, right? But now it makes sense to integrate them on cycles, and they have logarithmic singularities. In fact, that's what I was just saying a second ago, is that not only do they have logarithmic singularities, but you can give the image of the amplitudehedron in this 4K dimensional space. What is the image? You look at the space of all z's that satisfy this winding or this sign flip condition. That's some subspace of the space of all possible z's. So in the full configuration space of just n four-dimensional z's, there is a subspace that has the correct winding, right? Or the correct sign flips. And now that's still a top-dimensional subspace, but this is a 4K form. So what you need to do is identify a nice 4K dimensional submanifold on which you pull back this form and then declare it has logarithmic singularities there. And the way you identify the 4K dimensional subspace is just take any, it's like you have a point and then you translate along a line to get a one dimensional space. So you take the z's and you translate them in the direction of a fixed K dimensional subspace. So the space of all z's translated starting from a given z along a k-dimensional subspace is all those z's that you can get are as if you started with a 4 plus k-dimensional data and you projected through a k-plane. So that's the image of the amplitudehedron, but directly in this bosonic momentum twister space. And then everywhere along that configuration where you have the correct sign flips or the correct winding is the inside of the amplitudehedron. So you take this form, which is the superamplitude, and it has logarithmic singularities on the boundaries of that region. OK, but so what about loops? Well, as I mentioned already, and again, those of you who have suffered through talks of mine over the past 6, 7 years know I've been absolutely obsessed with this idea that loops are hiding particles. And there's a sense in which it's true even without fancy schmancy Grassmannian stuff. There's a much better sense in which it was true with the amplitudehedron in the usual way. But it still was not quite the perfect. But the story now, I think, is as close to perfect as I can imagine it getting, in the sense that it doesn't involve extra auxiliary stuff. So let me tell you what the story is. So imagine you have this. Imagine you have a bunch of z's. Here's a bunch of z's. I'm projected through y. So here's y of a bunch of z's. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Okay? And okay. So I can't really see it now. I haven't drawn it nicely, but these are supposed to live in a four-dimensional space, okay? Because m is equal to a 4. Okay. Now let's say I take two adjacent z's, let's say z6 and z7, and I say, look, I want to ignore I want to ignore 6 and 7. I want to forget about 6 and 7. But the only thing I want to remember is what line they made. Okay? So I just want to keep track of the information about the line, but ignore where 6 and 7 are on the line. OK, so go ahead and do it. Okay. Okay. But now, 6 and 7 used to be playing a role before. Because if I projected through 6 or projected through 7, if I projected through a 6, 7, to go down lower, I needed to have k sign flips, right? Now I don't have 6 and 7 anymore. So what can I do? I can't project through them anymore. But what I can do is notice that, oh, wait a minute, y in this line together is actually, you know, y was a k plane. So y in this line together is a k plus 2 plane, right? And so what this picture looks like is an incomplete projection. It's an incomplete projection. It's as if I started with a k plus 2 plane, and I haven't projected all the way. I want to project through k directions, and I want to project through the remaining two directions. So if I project through the remaining two directions, I'm going to go from m equals 4 to m equals 2. And the claim is that So now what do I have? In this geometry, I have a bunch of z's. I have this line. Now I don't know the line secretly came from a 6 and a 7. It's gone, right? But this line and y together have to have the property that if I project through them, the only thing that makes sense now is that this y and the line were part of a k plus 2 plane, and I should end in the m equals 2 amplitudehedron. Okay? So what this tells us is, and this is why, as I said, there's a role for all of the m's in this story, okay? Is that, in fact, loops are the following. So let's say I'm doing one loop. One loop, the claim is that if I project through, my data is a y, is a k-plane y, as well as some line AB. But what I really have is, what it really is a k plus 2 plane that I can call YAB, with a particular k-plane y inside it. Okay, so that's just the way we think about loops, is that we have a one loop is a k plus 2 plane with a marked k-plane inside it. If I have L loops, I have a whole bunch of k plus 2 planes, YAB1, YAB2, and again, they intersect on some k-plane. So these are k plus 2 planes,
and they intersect on the same k-plane y. So what is the empty-hedron then? The empty-hedron is simply the intersection of the m equals 2 empty-hedra with the m equals 4 empty-hedra. Nothing else. In other words, it means that that you have to have a k plus 2 plane, which is in the m equals 2 empty-hedron, and in it there's a k-plane. In it there's a k-plane. That k-plane needs to be in the m equals 4 empty-hedron. And that's it. So in terms of sign flips, then, here is the final definition of the empty-hedron at for any number of loops. I have a bunch of YAB sub I for I equals 1 to L. As I said, the most efficient way of saying it is in terms of all the boundaries first. So we have all the ZA, ZA plus 1, ZB, ZB plus 1 are positive. We have all the YAB sub I, ZA, ZA plus 1 are positive. These are the sort of usual physical boundaries. And this is so this is saying that sort of all the distances between all the various points, the standard boundaries are a positive. And on top of that, we have to have that y 1, 2, 3, 4 up to y 1, 2, 3, n has k sign flips. And for any I, y a, b, I 1, 2 up to y a, b, I 1, n has k plus 2 sign flips. And that's it. So what this means, for example, one loop. What is one loop? So it means that the m equals 2 empty-hedron is the seed of loops. Okay? Is it? So for any k, there's the m equals 2 amplitude is a very simple object. It is a very simple triangulation. If I had longer, we could actually triangulate. We could triangulate it very simply just by writing these sign patterns and just seeing where the transitions from the pluses. When the sign flips occur, you can just you can completely cover the space just by writing down where the sign flips occur, and in that way explicitly calculate simple amplitude. But if we jump to, for example, k equals 1 at one loop, the picture is simply that a two plane. You have a two plane. In P4, and it's sitting inside its empty-hedron that lives inside. You have a two-plane in P4 that lives inside the m equals 2, n equals 5, effectively k equals 3 empty-hedron. And then on this plane, now on top of that, you have the simplex that's made up of the external data. Now, it's a four-dimensional space. I'm only drawing a three-dimensional projection of it. But it's like having a tetrahedron in this space. And then this plane just passes through the tetrahedron somewhere. And the marked point on the k-plane has just got to be inside the tetrahedron. So it's literally the intersection of the two spaces. So if you know what the NMHV one-loop amplitude looks like, the simplest case has 5 points. I drew the 5-point case there. So if you just imagine the intersection of a plane with a simplex, the intersection looks like a pentagon. And so you triangulate the pentagon in sum of 3 terms, and that's the famous 3-term formula for the NMHV one-loop amplitude in that case. Okay? But in this way, you can just manually triangulate the NMHV one-loop amplitudes. Something which is interesting is that this triangulation, as far as I can tell, does not correspond to a BCFW triangulation. It's some other triangulation, although it might correspond to it in some disguise, but I haven't been able to identify. The other thing that this picture makes manifest is what is the general structure for any number of loops. The general structure has one piece, which is just like 4 particles at any number of loops. See, 4 particles at any number of loops, there's no y. These positivities are sort of trivial, and it's mostly about the mutual positivity of ABI and ABJ. So if you take the space, which just has all these loops mutually positive to each other, that is a big space, And that space, without any winding conditions or any sign flip conditions, that space computes the form with logarithmic singularities on the boundaries of that space, computes the correlator in the light-like limit. Okay? It's not the amplitude, it's the correlator in the light-like limit. So people have noticed that when you take the correlator in the light-like limit, you can, it's the sum of a bunch it's the mod squared of the amplitude, and you can pick off the different pieces of the amplitude with some work. But what it is, from this point of view, is just the form of logarithmic singularity just when you impose ABI, ABJ positive. So just the mutual positivity of these loop variables. If on top of that you put the sign flip condition or the winding condition, then you can pick off either the MHV or the MHV bar or all the mixed possible cases in between. So that's one part of it. This part is like four particles to all loops. There is one loop to any n and k. That's the m equals 1 amplitudehedron. And there is the tree amplitudehedron, okay, which is m equals 4. And it's roughly speaking the intersection of these three worlds, which is the general amplitude. Okay? So that's something which we hadn't seen before. Is why is it that four particles are somehow special? Why is it that so? And now, from this picture, it's clear that there's these sort of three different pieces of the geometry, and they literally sort of intersect on top of each other, and the mutual intersection of all of them is the full amplitudehedron. All right, I've gone on a long time, so I think that's all I'll say for now. Thank you.